Hello.
And welcome.
It's the Graveyard Girls, a true crime and mysteries podcast.
Yes.
And it's part two of your DB Cooper case.
Yes. So we obviously had to split this one because it's a mammoth one, which at the moment I really seem to be getting into because we've got the mammoth witch trials that are starting now. So, yeah, apparently I like big juicy cases. I think they are really interesting to write up about, especially if they've got a few twists and turns.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I get really engrossed in, because I don't want to panic you, but I've also, once the witch trials are finished, I've also nearly written enough Patreon to take me up to all the new year. Because, I've not written them. I know what cases I'm doing. I've already written them down. And I have a Christmas special.
Well, don't say you've written them, because I'm like,
We're not even... Anywhere near that yet. Well, I say that, but it'll come up quick. But yeah, I have my Patreon and some of my normal cases planned because I've been watching a few documentaries. And given me a lot of ideas for cases, not going to lie.
So, okay.
I've got cases sorted well into next year. So I'm sorted. I just got to write them.
Oh, okay.
No
I'm behind.
But yes. Anyway, back onto the case. So I'll do a tiny recap, but basically anyone that tuned in last Thursday, if you didn't, you might want to pause this and go back and watch Thursday's episode, which was part one, because this will make a hell of a lot more sense if you go and do that first. Basically, in the first episode, we explained the hijacking that happened in November 1971, in which a man by the name of, well, his name was Dan Cooper, but he was reported as D.B. Cooper, ordered ransom money of £200,000. And claimed to have a bomb and would fly off mid-flight when the plane has been refueled and takes back off again. At this point, I don't think he has very good survival prospects, but we've already looked at the first sort of four or five possible suspects. So
they were good suspects, to be honest.
They were good suspects. And it's also worth noting, like, certain things that he'd said. Like when he asked for the currency, he asked for...
American...
Yeah, it was an important word. Where's it gone? He asked for a negotiable American currency, which later on when I touch on this, someone could suggest that maybe he wasn't born in America.
Okay.
So it's just worth noting that. I thought I'd point that out.
Canadian?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But obviously you get French-Canadian as well. Mm. So even though the person said he didn't have an accent, if he could have been born... quite early on, born early on in Canada, he could have maybe had some family that was French Canadian, but he's always spoke Canadian. So even though Canadian and American accents are different, I think maybe in a panic you could maybe kind of confuse the two. You might not, it's not like you're gonna hear a German accent and think that's not American.
It goes along with him being polite. He's a polite terrorist. He's Canadian. There you go, it's sorted. Okay.
But I will get on to the Canadian bit in a little while. So first of all, I'm going to continue with the suspects. So this next man is a man that goes by the name of John Richard Briggs, but was also known as Dick Briggs. We couldn't get in without having a penis or a vagina. So we've got a dick. Anyway, he was a criminal who supplied cocaine and various other drugs, but mainly cocaine.
Okay.
So he came to the attention of police when another criminal by the name of Ron Carson, who was a drug trafficker, said on an interview claiming that he knew who D.B. Cooper was. Now, Ron claimed that Dick Briggs told him, as well as other people, that he himself was D.B. Cooper. No one really believed him, and that was until in 1980 when he held a party. Now, Ron attended this party, and there Dick told him that he did it and he'd hidden the money, but that it would resurface soon. He pointed to a couple, a hippie-looking couple, and said, they will find it on the beach at the North Shore. Now, if you remember, in the last episode, I mentioned the little boy, Brian.
Yeah.
Sure enough, on February the 10th, 1980, money adding to the total of $5,800 was found, and the money, and this was money given in the hijacking. The serial numbers matched.
Is he like a prophet? Why is he like, oh, they're going to find it? No. I don't know.
So yes, and believe it or not, that money was the money found by 8-year-old Brian Ingham.
No.
But when it was published in papers and on the TV, guess who Brian's parents were? That's right, the couple at the party.
No.
So, it's right.
Convenient. No, I don't like it.
I know. So you think case closed, but it's not.
No, that's a fake story.
So it does sound like they have the guy. And this is where it gets interesting. Now, in conversations with Ron, Dick told him that he used to be a work in the special forces. He'd been to Vietnam and was a parachutist. Dick was a very intelligent man, but was known for his temper and his behaviour would spiral out of control. Some said he was bipolar. One person claimed that when he'd come to theirs, they poured him a drink, and not long after he had a fit of rage in which he bit into and proceeded to eat the glass.
What?
Now, yeah. It's worth also noting this because people believed he had no sense of pain. Now, it sounds a bit far-fetched at the moment, but bear with me. If he jumped off the plane, let's say he did sustain a broken leg or a broken arm, he's clearly got a good tolerance of pain, and this is backed up by Ron himself, who said he'd witnessed him on multiple occasions doing things like putting pins all the way through his arm, even without flinching. So he'd put it through one side and the other. So they're saying, could he survive severe injuries? Because some people do have ridiculously high pain threshold. So at first, I was already a bit sceptical of this, but I'll continue with it and kind of explain it a little bit more as we go along.
I don't like it.
So Dick also went to an annual D.B. Cooper festival with Ron, and Ron claimed that he said, all I want to do is tell these people who I am. They're here for me. Ron didn't give his interview until much later. This was in 2011, but police did take interest. They did 3 interviews with Ron and a polygraph test, which I know they're not conclusive, but Ron passed them ultimately, and all the questions that they asked related to what Dick had told him. So this is where, for me, yes, Ron, what he was told by Dick, he genuinely believed.
Yes.
So it made him seem, because he then passed the polygraph test, it sparked police interest, because well, they were expecting Ron to lie and fail the polygraph test, and he didn't. So now they're thinking, oh, hang on a minute.
Yeah. But he clearly just believes everything this guy's just told him. Not that that's who he is.
Yeah. And this was it. And this Ron Carlson will later do an interview. He actually comes back to the documentary that I watched the other day.
Yeah.
And he says that he kind of felt off on that. I know you can take this with a pinch of salt because ultimately he's a criminal, so he's done naughty things. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that everything he does is bad.
Mm.
But he said he was so convinced himself. He said he couldn't believe it when it was later disproved. And I'll explain why it's disproved later. The thing is how would he know about it, like to get about the money? Because that was very... For him to announce that literally days before it happened.
That's weird. Either they're in on it or... And they buried it, or he heard them going to the beach... Or he's a weird prophet.
I think it's a case of, I think because he's in the same criminal gang as them, could he, like you sort of said about them overhearing it, all it takes is for them to say, we're going to go, we need to dig up the money that we buried before, although I'll explain that in a minute, but, and he's overheard it and thought, right, okay, I'm going to tell it, and now everyone's got to believe me because I told them that that couple were about to find it, and his son did find it.
Okay.
The only reason this kind of gets thrown out a bit later is when they looked at the father of Brian, they couldn't find any criminal links with him, which then also throws out the thing of how was he even at the party in the first place? Was he just, you know, like the couple had ended there, were they friends and not like criminal friends? They were just friends of people within the criminal gang.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean? Yeah, yeah. And the reason the police threw them out is because they couldn't link them with anything criminal specifically. So they sort of said Brian was innocent, and which goes back to what you said earlier, but I just thought it was very interesting in terms of, especially when this documentary was cropping up and they started saying this, I was like, when they started saying it, I was like, yeah, Dick's gotta be the guy. Because, and then when that money thing came up, I was a bit like, okay, it's a bit iffy, but also now I am thinking about it, because I know Ron, like I said, obviously clearly believed what Dick said, but there is also an element, well, what if he is right? So I'll continue down that line.
Okay.
So, now, they couldn't interview Dick because he died on December 1980 in a car crash. So, that was so many months after the money had been found. So, the money had been found in February, he died in the December. Now, police ultimately ruled his death as an accident, but some of Dick's friends said it was suspicious. He had links as well with an automobile company, and there'd been some disputes with other people. And some said because he was bragging about being Cooper, even if he wasn't actually Cooper, was his death made to look like an accident? And the police are just either not bothered because it's another criminal, or it unloads something else. It maybe ruins another one of their undercover cases, so they cover it up as an accident. That was what was sort of thrown out. But I don't want to go too much in that because it massively divulges away from the case. But if anyone wants to go and look at it, it's definitely worth a little look. Now, obviously, the police naturally had to investigate the claims. Now, the reason the police also ruled him out as being Kubo is because he didn't match the description at all. Now, whereas in terms of like his face and facial features, yeah, he did match pretty good. The issue was his height. Now, Dick was a short, very stocky man, basically built like a tank, whereas D.B. Cooper was a slender, tall man.
Yeah.
So, in terms of that, he's not matching at all. And also, when they looked at him, they discovered him to be a fraud, as he'd never actually served or been to Vietnam, and he hadn't parachuted. So, this is obviously a major thing now. So, he obviously did a good job of convincing, because Ron and many others believed him. And obviously Ron passed his polygraph test.
Yeah.
Now, he's obviously been ruled out, but he ultimately put police onto, and a police consultant, Tom Colbert, onto who he believes is D.B. Cooper, and that is the man by the name of Robert Rackstraw. Now, this for me, when I watched the documentary, this is what brought me back. So anyone that's already, obviously, hopefully listened to the previous episode, right at the beginning, I'd said about when they move on to this next guy, I feel like, at first, he's a very good suspect.
Mm.
But in Tom Colbert's pursuit of the man, I feel like he's gone a little bit one track and it becomes a personal agenda. Now, I also said that I'd previously watched a documentary, and I had. This had come back in 2016 on the History Channel. And what frustrated me was they put forward lots of circumstantial evidence, nothing proved or linked to this man. And there was no ultimately no resolve. You were no, if anything, you were far further away from who I thought a suspect was than when you got closer. But I can't not mention this man.
Okay.
So I'll basically get into Robert Rackstraw and who he was. Now, Robert would be the main suspect for Tom Colbert. Now, he was a consultant with the police, but also did a lot of journalism sort of stuff. And he hired 40 private/retired police investigators, some from the FBI. It became an obsession for Tom. The investigation would spread over 5 years. So who was Rackstraw? Robert Wesley Rackstraw was born in 1943 and was a retired pilot and ex-convict who served in the who served on an army helicopter and other units during the Vietnam War. He came to the attention of the Cooper Task Force first in February 1978 after he'd been arrested in Iran and deported back to the US to face charges for possession of explosives, and to check kiting charges, which is basically like a check fraud.
Oh, okay.
So obviously linked with money, explosive, you want to link that with a bomb.
Okay.
Pretty good suspect back in the time. So this is literally not long, 7 years after the hijacking. So it's still quite close to the hijacking. I see why he became quite a good suspect.
Yeah.
Now, several months later, while on bail, so this is back still late 1978, Robert attempted to fake his own death by radioing a false Mayday call and telling controllers that he was bailing out of a rented plane over Monterey Bay. Police later arrested him in Fullerton, California, on an additional charge of forgering federal pilot certificates. The plane he claimed to have crashed and bailed out of was found repainted in a nearby hangar.
Okay.
So already quite close things with hijacking. He's made suggestions of a hijacking. I know it was to cover up a fake death, but still, you want to make the links. It's looking quite good. He does resemble the Cooper composite sketches, although he would have only been 28 at the time, and they were looking for a man in his 40s.
Yeah.
He was eliminated as a suspect in 1979 after no direct evidence could be found. So he's basically unrelated to it up until Tom Colbert. Now, Tom Colbert would become obsessed with Robert and put him back in the picture in 2016. So quite a considerable, good few decades later. In 2017, Colbert and a group of investigators would claim to find a parachute strap in an undisclosed location in the Pacific Northwest. Tom and a lady who I think has the same surname, so I believe it to be his wife, although it could be a family member, reported they obtained a confession letter originally written in December 1971 containing codes that matches three of Rackstraw's, it's not divisions in the US, the army groups that we're in. It's divisions here. Is it divisions in army in the US? You've got all your different, the groups you're with. So I can't think of the word. It might be rank. Yeah, the ranks he was with. They, however, could represent many other codes as well as this. They initially based it on letters and numbers matching in alphabetical order. So A equals 1, B equals 2, etc. Rackstraw was also linked to other crimes and he had been a skilled pilot, but had been dishonorably discharged during the Vietnam War. Colbert believed this gave him the skill set as well as motivation to commit the hijacking. He obviously liked to challenge authority and he would have gained money from this, and he was obviously struggling for money after being dishonorably discharged.
Yeah.
He also falsified military records, kept explosives, and had been charged for domestic violence. Mm-hmm. He'd also been in charge in charged in connection with a suspicious death of his stepfather, though he was never convicted of that crime. So worth noting it, but I don't know as though it's relevant. But for Tom Colbert, it obviously was. Now, where Tom, for me, kind of loses his credit, and it's where his obsession clearly starts, is as part of his five-year investigation, he follows Rackshaw everywhere, and I mean everywhere. He trails him for months, and he's recording him. So, like, he's doing, like...
Surveillance.
Yeah. He rings him numerous times trying to get his side of the story. So he starts with, like, oh, you should just tell us your side, blah, blah, blah. He then tries to bribe him with money, and I'd like to note that Robert does not buy in this at all. Now, this is included in the 2016 documentary.
Mm-hmm.
He trails him everywhere. Wherever he goes, he's like, give us an interview, blah, blah, blah. He follows him the way around. Like, to me, like, it's like an element of stalking.
Yeah, it's obsessive.
Mm. Tom then, once that isn't working, he enlists the help of James, or also known as Jim Forbes, who also trails him and approaches Robert multiple times. Now, this James Forbes, he does a lot of documentaries, he's a big journalist, and he gets massive interviews. So I think Tom was sort of hoping by having him on board, Robert might bite on the money thing because it would give him prime time TV. Didn't work, still didn't budge. So for me, I'm already thinking, yeah, okay, now I'm not so sure. Either, yes, he could really be thinking, I don't want to get involved in it. But also at this point, he's never going to spend any criminal time for it. So if he did do it, why not just claim that it was him? The fact that he's still avoiding it is starting to give me a sort of doubt as to whether he could have done it.
Think about it. It might be good to get rid of that element of the mystery, but just imagine pulling off history's greatest mystery.
Yeah.
And then you ruin it by being like, yeah, it was me.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either.
Why can't you continue with the facade, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would.
Hmm.
So, once collecting all of the bits that Tom had for his investigation, and what he believes he needs to convict Robert, he makes a documentary, which aired on the History Channel. This 2016 documentary is when Tom presents his evidence, but it's kind of explained away when he presents it. It's explained away by multiple people and is discredited by a lot of them and disregarded by others, with many quoting that he was literally making the evidence fit his theory.
Yeah.
And this does kind of make sense to me. Like, some of the evidence could work for his theory, but it's all circumstantial and there's also other explanations for it. Like, if... there's no physical evidence actually connecting Robert to it. If they found DNA, I could have gone, yeah, okay, it works. Even though there was other explanations, for, well, you've tied DNA now, so it had to have been Robert.
Yeah.
All of it was circumstantial. None of it DNA. And like I said, Robert could have done it based on this circumstantial evidence, but it was all circumstantial. Now...
I don't like that he's obsessed with this man.
No, neither do I. And now, at the same time, as this... documents about to air, so as they present it all and take it to another detective, basically, you know, like things where they do like a cold casing, they gather all the information and then they take it to the FBI and ask the FBI to look into it. That's effectively what Tom Colbert's doing now.
Okay.
And in this bit, the FBI say, no, we're not looking at it. And at the same time, the way they explain why they're not, James Forbes, who was obviously the journalist, he learns of Robert's decline in health. So at this point, even though they're making the documentary and putting it forward, Tom is still pushing to get a confession, and he's sending him to it. So obviously, That's what Tom's pushing for. Jim Forbes learns of Robert's declining health and refuses to follow, or as I put it, stalk Robert for a confession anymore on behalf of Tom, which, fair point to him. He then separates himself from Tom and Robert as a suspect, and basically at the back end of this documentary, he almost goes to the other side, and this Jim Forbes, so this big guy who does a documentary, basically said, I don't think it was Robert, which completely screws things over for Tom, because a lot of his information he got and everything is all based off what he managed to obtain through interviews with Jim. So it's really not helping him anymore. Now, Tom makes things worse for himself when he starts to slate the witnesses to the hijacking. So the stewardesses, Tina Mucklow, and her connection with memory loss during the hijacking, which could have made would have made her testimony a bit shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't have been the best testimony to use in court at trial. He also questioned two FBI agents who had questioned Tina at the time of the hijacking, because apparently one of them had given an interview since, so this is early 2000s, saying that they wouldn't, she was too traumatized when she gave her original evidence and wouldn't have been able to identify anyone from a photo. Now, obviously, all their composite sketches are based off what Tina and the other stewardesses are saying, so then that means it throws up the whole... Well, the composite sketches don't work. Tom then blamed them. Tina would give a later interview to Tom for his documentary. Tom blamed those two FBI agents for encouraging Tina to look at Tom's photos he had of possible suspects, and said that they set him up to fail. So rather than saying, I've got it wrong, or I've not got enough evidence, it's all circumstantial, he's blaming those other FBI agents. Because obviously the interview they've now given kind of throws up whether Tina was the most viable person. And in the photos that Tom shows, she says that Robert Rackshaw is quite a good resemblance, but obviously if they're those FBI agents are now saying she can't positively identify, it's another piece of evidence that Tom's now lost, because he based a big thing with her about, well, she said it looks pretty much identical to him, so it's another piece of evidence. And she was a witness, she was there, she thinks it looks like him. Do you see what I mean? It's another bit of his work that's been discredited, but it's almost like he's had a bit of a paddy about it.
Yes, it is. It's just like, well, it's your fault I got it wrong.
Yeah.
No.
And I think for me, it's like he got so obsessed with this case. I don't think he was doing it on purpose. I think he genuinely thought he was right.
Yeah.
And he's just gone down this track. Now, another flaw that was found in Tom's work was he also failed to properly look at critical pieces of evidence, such as the titanium shards found on the tie, as well as the DNA evidence found on the tie. So far, no links to Robert have actually been made. Now, Tom basically presents all of his evidence as circumstantial, and none of it can be conclusively linked to Robert, so nothing through DNA or anything like that. Okay. And crucially, Tom had never, even though he had several high-profile FBI agents working for him, none of them went looking for the missing cigarette butts, which had previously been collected by the FBI. And they obviously would have had conclusive DNA on them, or could have, most likely would have. That ultimately would have proved whether Robert did or didn't do it. They didn't do anything about cigarette butts. They didn't even attempt to look at it. Now, most of his private investigators were part of the FBI. So he's saying, a big bolster for his case was, look, I've got actual FBI agents on it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They're not looking at actual hard evidence. They're only gathering circumstantial stuff. And like when it goes back to when they found the parachute straps, that was actually found later on in the documentary than obviously I've mentioned it before. But the way it was sort of done is when they found them, as soon as he said that, I thought, there's no way it's fucking that. Basically, they were already struggling for evidence. They go looking at possible sites where the person could have landed, and someone else goes, yeah, let's just dig here. They start digging there, they found a parachute strap. I was like, bit convenient. And also, it was a really generic strap. It could have belonged to any type of parachute.
Okay.
It didn't have to be that type of parachute.
Yeah.
And I just think, so you're telling me all these people have spent all these years searching, no one else managed to find it, but apparently they had undisclosed information and that no one else had had before. But again, it was all circumstantial, and ultimately there was no DNA on it, so they couldn't relate it to Robert. But I think there was a thing about the colour of the straps and the bag that was then located nearby was the same colour as one Robert had in a photo. So, yeah, basically, but unless I'm mistaken, bags are mass-produced, so, you know, so it could have been anyone. But for them, it was like, it was another piece that links them to Robert. Mm. But it wasn't, because there's no DNA proof. So I was already a bit like, okay, you've really poo-pooed yourself here. Now, as a result, many actually questioned the History Channel as to why they would even put such a huge documentary on, which contained no definitive proof and no confession from Rackstraw and offers no resolution. Now, that documentary is the one I watched back in 2016, but I don't think it came out here until about 2017. And that's the one when I first heard about D.V. Cooper.
Yeah.
And obviously for me, I got massively frustrated with that thing. I was just like, I've just watched hours of this documentary and you're none the wiser. Like, it genuinely sounded like they were going to solve it. And I was like, you've given me nothing. There's absolutely nothing. If anything, I'm further away from thinking it was him than I was at the beginning. He started off pretty good and now you've completely ruled him out. Especially with his previous convictions for other stuff. Now, for me, I then obviously went and a mixture with this documentary, and then I obviously did a little bit of digging on Robert. It's also worth noting that at the same time of Tom's documentary was released to the very same week that was released in 2016, the FBI officially closed the case, saying that there was nothing else to go on.
Mm.
They couldn't solve it, end of, which was had a detrimental impact on Tom, because he was so certain that he'd found the guys, he'd gone to the FBI, and people throughout that the FBI were trying to do is a cover-up because Tom had discovered the answer. But why would the FBI want to cover it up and not solve it? I don't get it.
No.
Do you know what I mean? It's
just another convenient story for Tom.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, we found him, but like the FBI don't want anything to do with it. They're not interested
anymore.
They're covering it up.
Yeah.
It's just weird. I don't like it.
So after, it's also worth noting, now obviously Robert's charges were the end of like the late 1970s, early 1980s.
Hmm.
After that, after his charges, he settled down and hadn't been linked to any other crime since. Doesn't mean he didn't do any, but he obviously hasn't been linked to any. So it would seem that he'd redeemed himself and tried to move on. He led a quiet life until Tom put him back in the spotlight in 2016. So he'd gone all the way from the 80s to 2016 with nothing. Absolutely nothing. He lived a quiet life, effectively been forgotten about.
And then Tom comes along, just like, he did it.
Yeah.
Trying to upend his life to feel like what? Because he thinks he's right?
Yeah. I think it is literally a classic case of he got... So, I think what he started off with, he was a good suspect. When, like I said, when you look at the beginning of it, you're like, yeah, he is a strong suspect. Maybe the FBI did miss it at the time. There just wasn't enough evidence. If we reopen it and re-look into him, we might find the DNA evidence. Where Tom's issue was all the new evidence he found was circumstantial. And at one point, this thing with the letter in the code, it never been deciphered. No one could decipher it. And it was a guy who had served time in the military, who apparently had served time with Robert. He looked at the codes and he was the one that matched up and goes, I know Robert, I know the sort of codes we would have learned because we learned them together. If he used the codes of how he knew Robert would have been taught to do it, it came back as Robert Rackstraw. So they were saying, there you go, we've solved it for all the reason. The reason we couldn't solve it before was because it was linked with that individual part of the army, and it was like a secret code cracking thing. But again, then when someone else looked into it, they were saying, but also if you looked at it from other points of view, it could also mean other things. And it was something to do with the letters, depending on whether you wanted to do it in reverse numerical, so like A being 1 or A being 26, depending on which way you looked at it, it spelled completely different words.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, if you do it in the reverse order and it spells something completely different, you've not cracked the case, have you?
No.
So it was a case of it then kind of threw that evidence out. And at first it was like a really good point. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. And then all of a sudden I was like, yeah, okay, now it's discredited. Do you know what I mean? When you keep looking at it, it's like 1 minute you go, woo, I've got something. Oh, wait, no, that's too shit now. I don't believe you anymore. So this, for me, is then where it got into, well, if it's not Robert, who is it?
Mm.
And who is the most plausible? Now, this case is said to have something that in the more recent years, as the internet's taken off, they've given it something called the Cooper Curse, and basically saying no one will ever be able to solve it. So many people have got so close, and just as they're about to put that final piece together, something blows it out, and they can't prove it anymore. So they call it the Cooper Curse. Now, obviously, the internet is full of conspiracy theories, and if it wasn't, we wouldn't be making podcasts like this, because we wouldn't be able to look into these unsolved mysteries. But there is a hell of a lot of plausible ones. They just can't be proven.
Mm.
But and they're coming from all different angles. Now, this recent Netflix documentary interviews a man by the name of Darren Schaefer, who actually hosts a podcast all about D.P. Cooper called The Cooper Vortex. Now, his whole podcast is dedicated to this. And he also goes along nowadays, you know, like conventions and things like that. They have one dedicated just to D.P. Cooper, and it goes up and all around America. This guy goes around to sort of quite a large number of these. Now, I did start to listen to a bit of one of his episodes after I'd listened to the interview, and he's one of those that kind of discredits Tom and a lot of stuff he said in the Netflix. Without me going into too much detail about it, I agree with what he's saying in regards to Tom.
Yeah.
He brings up a lot of points, but I definitely think he's one worth going to have a little look at if you want to delve more into this case, because he brings up so many valid points. But if I was to go into all of them now, bloody hell, the episode would go on forever. So anyone that's interested, I will obviously tag him in our Instagram post as well. So if anyone wants to go and have a little listen to that, then that might be something they're interested in doing. Now, the Netflix documentary looks at a comic book, and this is partly due to what Darren brings up. And this, for me, it's kind of a... It doesn't give you a pinpoint suspect, but I really like this theory.
Okay.
Now, this is The Adventures of Dan Cooper, a French comic series about a fictional Canadian military pilot. Now, first published in 1957, so it was out before the hijackings. Was it the inspiration for D.B. Cooper? Now, it was written in French. However, others put forward that links with the comic book include a there's an episode in it, and that the hijacker might have worked in the airbase in which the writer of the comic book, Alfred Weinberg, regularly visited to accurately depict the character. So basically, Albert, who wrote these comics, actually went to airfields and spoke to actual people that worked in these places so he could accurately depict D.B. Cooper. So if you want to look at it, he also looked and asked questions about like how someone would jump out of a plane, and the hijacker couldn't have inside knowledge of the comic and wouldn't necessarily be able to read French, because if he's had an actual conversation with the writer, he could create an alias, but it would also, so basically he could have a conversation with the writer, if you like. The writer in that place is going, oh, well, how would this work? How would that work? He's getting the information. He doesn't have to read the comic book. Even if he goes back later and looks at the comic pictures, he can put together what Albert had told him without being able to physically need to read the French, sorry.
Yeah.
But in him also meeting Albert in these places, the hangars where this stuff would have been, that person could have come into contact with the titanium flex found on the tie. So not only would he have knowledge of this thing, it would give him the name, the inspiration, the alias, the Dan Cooper, and it just so happens that this comic is about the pilot Dan Cooper, which, if you take out the B, which was misprinted by the media, it's a perfect match. Now, it's not like this comic came out afterwards, it was out years before.
Yeah.
So could it have been a case of the person that was the actual D.B. Cooper, could he have worked in Canada? Because if you want to go back to how I made about the negotiable American currency, someone suggested he could have been Canadian and not American.
Okay.
Remember I made that? If you want to go back to that. If he's working in the hangars where these planes are made, where the guy who writes the comic goes to visit to get his inspiration. I know it's quite far-fetched, but I really, really like the idea.
It's a good
that this
theory.
Guy is basically, he lives and works in Canada. He's met the guy of these comics. He knows what's going to happen in these comics because he's met the author and illustrator. He then, whatever reason, it ends up in America. He's got the perfect hijacking. Yeah. He's got the perfect alias.
It's a very good theory.
It's a really good theory. And there's no way of proving it, because who could that guy be? There were so many people that worked there. I know, instantly you could go, well, just look at any of them that went to America, but...
But it's also, there's no guaranteed fact Dan or D.B. Cooper survived the fall.
Yeah, exactly.
So any of these, it could be no one.
Yeah.
Who disappeared after that day? Look at them.
Yeah.
Not the people who are
still alive.
There'll
be hundreds of people that disappeared.
I do like the comic book theory.
But
that's
absolutely love how this comic book was brought into it. As soon as I started hearing that at the end of the documentary, I thought, do you know what? It's brilliant. Because I'd start to get a bit pissed off with the documentary and almost didn't listen to the last episode. Because I thought it's going exactly the same way as it did before.
Yeah.
You're not going to resolve it. And like, they haven't resolved it, but they threw out nothing good, nothing that inspired me to think, oh, actually, this was a worthwhile documentary. I just thought, have I wasted 4 hours of my life again? listening to multiple of these episodes, but like I said, this guy that does the Vortex
That's why they did it right at the end.
Yeah. And it was brilliant, because like I said, even with the Dick Briggs one, at first you were like, when they first started doing him, you're like, okay, this is a really good suspect. They've just got to find the evidence, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Ron passed the thing. Okay, now it's thrown out. We've proven he's a fraud. But he had connections to Robert Rackshaw, Straw. So then you were like, okay, well, he could have got his inside information from Robert if Robert was really the guy. And then this Tom sounds so plausible at the beginning. The way they do it is they take the bits out. And it wasn't until I started looking at that bit, I was like, I'm sure I've watched a documentary with this Tom guy in before. And then when in the third episode they mentioned that he'd had a previous documentary, and I thought, I knew I'd fucking seen this before.
And I think then, I've seen one with him.
Yeah. And then it was like, hang on a minute, I'm discrediting it. And then they started bringing in other people who were not shitting on Tom, but they were shitting on him, if you like. And they were then disproving everything we're saying. I was like, yes, I remember now why I got really frustrated with this other documentary. And then I was like, I don't believe it's Robert anymore. And then, especially when that Jim Forbes guy was like, yeah, no, I don't think it's him anymore. And obviously his decline in health. I thought, yeah, they've just ambushed this guy, just effectively. But then I was like, well, they can't leave it there, because then they've just done exactly what that previous documentary did. And then that's when that guy, they started going to the convention and they were looking at other theories. And, you know, when they brought the comic book up, that's you can't make that shit up. That is absolutely brilliant. Part of me hopes it is something like that. Like, you're never going to find it now. Because if the guy was in his 40s and the 70s, he's basically dead now.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to discover who he is.
I think he died anyway.
Yeah.
I think he's none of these people. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, it could be anything. If you want to be really out there, you could throw something like, maybe the guy was already dying. It was end of life. It was a last thrill. It's just something he decided to do off the cuff.
He jumped off the plane. Aliens took him away.
No, we are not having any fucking alien theories in this, Natasha.
There's no evidence of a body or a parachute. Some of the money fell onto the beach. That's
a bit for me, but I can almost explain that way. For like, what if it did land somewhere, someone found it before the police searched that area? They decide to deliberately bury it in the beach so that later on they can come up with another story.
Maybe.
Or wait for someone else to find it. Do you see what I mean? Like,
or they find it, dig it, because the police are looking for this money. They're like, oh, I'm going to bury it. I'll come back for
it
later. I'll
wait till it goes quiet and then I'll use it. Yeah, okay, that's quite a good idea.
And then someone else found it. They're like, oh, damn it.
Yeah. But aliens. I do get when that first came out and when they linked to that Dick Briggs and the couple that he'd had at the party with the parents of that kid. It first was a bit like, the first second I was like, oh, it's going to have to be him. And I was like, oh, it's been that. And then as they started to delve into a bit more, and I was like, no, I think he just, the criminal gangs that he had, because he was obviously dealt with cocaine and stuff, I think he just knew so many other criminals.
It's just a convenient story. It sounds like it's made up after the fact.
Yeah. It sounds case closed, but then it's very clearly not, when you unravel everything about Dick and you just realise, yeah, okay, it definitely wasn't him.
I like this comic book.
I really like this comic book. I can't believe I hadn't heard about it before now. Mm. It's just brilliant that this pilot is called Dan Cooper. But it wouldn't be hard, like I said, when we've looked at other cases. If you want to hide things, that's a perfect way to hide it. Name it after a comic book person. When someone finally discovers it, someone goes, well, it must be one of them, because that's where he's got the name from. That's where D.B. Cooper come from. It's actually Dan Cooper. And it could be something completely unrelated to the comic book. Just so happens that person read the comic book.
Exactly.
But it's a brilliant alias, isn't it?
It is.
And it's a brilliant link.
If they get it wrong as well. You're like, no, it's Dan Cooper. And they're like, no, D.B. Everyone's looking for DB and he's just like, for God's sake, it's Dan.
Yeah. But I thought, I've never had a case where it's related back to a comic book. It's just something so different in comparison to other cases. And that, for me, is why I decided to do an episode on it. Because at first, I was a bit put out that they still hadn't resolved it. And I couldn't put forward who I felt was a possible suspect. Like, these others, I think, like, I can come to the end and go, I think this person's quite a good and strong suspect. I have absolutely no idea in this case. I just really liked that comic book reference.
I see why you split it over two episodes.
Yeah. It's good. You had to do that, but you had to include those other suspects, because otherwise, I don't know, it would have just looked a bit one-sided, a bit like I looked at one person and that was it. But obviously, Robert was the main fundamentalist point. He's probably been the one that's been most investigated, I think, in terms of the actual case.
I think it's none of the people who are alive.
No, I don't. I think, like I said, I don't think the person even survived the fall. No. And if they did, they're definitely not alive now.
No.
They've took it to the grave. Because there's been so many people confessing on their deathbed. But they're so loosely linked.
Exactly.
But yeah, hopefully everyone enjoyed that. Like I said, it's worth looking at the documentary. I mean, I've maybe spoiled it a little bit now with revealing that Tom's everything, his ideas are shit. So maybe go and listen to that podcast, because I feel like...
What's the podcast again?
It's called The Cooper Vortex. Okay. And it's hosted by two guys, but one of the guy, Darren Schaefer, did I say who his name was?
Yes.
I did, yeah. He's one of the main hosts.
Okay.
And he featured in this documentary. So, yeah, I think it's worth going to have a little look at that. I think I'll go back and listen to the rest of the episodes, because I only looked at it a little bit just to double check it was definitely the same guy. But yeah, definitely when I get a bit of time, once we're finished recording these bloody witch trials, I think I'll go back and have a little look at it. Maybe explore a few more of suspects that they maybe drill up.
And then like part three.
Yeah, and do a part three maybe. Like a revisited sort of thing. But yeah, or if anyone else has any other suspects they think I might be interested in, then yeah, feel free to send that to us and I'll have a little nosy at some point.
On that note.
Yeah. In the meantime.
Keep creeping.
And we'll keep digging.